Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Giles of Rome. I wish I could pronounce it the way that educated people pronounce it, but I've actually never spoken with other educated people, so I don't know the actual classical way of pronouncing this particular philosopher. So he isn't an important philosopher, and therein lies some really interesting stuff. There's the philosophers everyone thinks they know. There's reading about them and understanding them a bit more deeply, like understanding Plato, understanding Kant, or just at least reading Kant and actually trying to get a bit of a fix between it. And then you realise that there are these hidden second-tier philosophers who are incredibly, incredibly important. One of them is Parmenides, a Greek philosopher who had the first non-religious philosophy non-religious philosophy which didn't have a philosophy which said relied at some point in God. So that was his very first one. He was the one that actually set forward the ideas which Plato and modern philosophy are based on. A very important second-tier philosopher. So Parmenides is someone who you don't hear of, and I didn't hear of, and it's only until I actually took the time to actually understand this person and understand the complexity of why it's sort of a bit hard to access him. So there's some twists and turns. Now, this Giles of Rome is a very important philosopher in terms of modern science, because he somehow stumbled upon the idea of mass, which somehow fed into Newton, which somehow fed into modern science. So in terms of the spark's really with him, but he's in the scholastic medieval. He's a medieval philosopher, and he's in the tradition of St. Thomas Aquinas and the Augustine order. So I don't quite understand. I'll probably have to understand a bit better. St. Thomas Aquinas is actually the high point of scholastic learning. It is where we look at books and compare experts, don't introduce our own experiments, get expertise. Now, one may say, oh, this is a very ancient medieval way of doing it, but a lot of our modern education system is really based on aping the scholastic medieval way of thinking. And of course, no doubt, our modern world and the medieval education system which goes into it. I'm not joking, I'm not being stupid. In a medieval way, people never came up with their own ideas. They actually looked at textbooks which were or the Bible, or books which were books of text, you would study the texts and you would derive information from that solely, and if there was contradictions of that was sort of a deeper understanding, or you could never break from it. So the height of that was St. Thomas Aquinas and his Summa Theologica. And he systematized basic arguments, where he thought exhaustively of every argument for and against, and systematically went through it to give you the only logical conclusion, allowing you to actually methodically chew through arguments. So it's a bit, if you'd like to think of it, it's a bit like the ancient pyramid. He would start from a base and build ever taller. There'd be no architectural structures or leaps of thought or reflection on the actual process of building it. We'd stuck to the same process. And that was scholastic viewpoint. But even then, scholasticism was having a bit of a problem with Aristotle. And Aristotle was your engineering approach to philosophy. Again, all these approaches to philosophy didn't have the benefit of experiments or science to do with them. So that's still, science really has a big impact on philosophy. Look, I dare say that one can think broadly, but our universe is actually defined by a few fundamental constants. And so I don't know, people seem to worry about the way things actually are, nature. But when you really come to think of it, philosophy is unbound by it. But Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas, the scholastic medieval method of thought, which is came out of the sort of chaotic Roman mind. So the Romans, they expanded but really didn't build in, they had systems to expand their state, but it wasn't a complete growth system. We had to sort of, if you like, restart a few times. Mathematically, they were limited. They didn't have a nought and various methods of calculations. They didn't have experiments. They didn't understand chance the way. There's a whole lot of fundamental things they didn't understand. And overall, it sort of led to a highly charged rhetoric spin advertising form. It's like the medieval would be your ultimate advertiser's dream, because you could just sell someone a jingle and they would believe it. They would go off and do anything. So you could, I would expect the modern person in going back to the future into medieval times would just really hurt their head looking at it. They would have people easily won by their arguments. In fact, it would be far too easy to operate in these times. So in this time, the medieval time, I think authors I've read, like The Name of the Rose, try to capture the medieval mind. And the medieval mind came into clash with an even more ancient open mind, the open mind of Aristotle. And of course, people were wrestling with Aristotle. Various people over the years have slowly walked away from Aristotle. Part of this conflict of Aristotle and the medieval mind produced some of the more advanced concepts, like mass. And then the mass went into Newton and incubated there for a while, until we actually went fully over into a more mathematical view of the world. So Newton himself was of the scholastic time. He said, "I feign no hypothesis, I only explain God's will as a mathematical phenomenon." So, Charles of Rome, let's hear about him. I know that you haven't, very few people know of him. No, I've only picked him up when I was actually trying to chase up for my own knowledge exactly the difference between matter and mass, the origin of the concepts, to see how they could be misunderstood. So this is episode 1, Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, Charles of Rome. First published in December 2001, substantial revision on Monday, November the 3rd, 2014. Okay, again, the author's not put here, but it says, Giles of Rome, who died in 1316 as Bishop of Bourges, I don't know where Bourges is, but it sounds French to me, was one of the most productive and influential thinkers active at the end of the 13th century. So he was active, and then he obviously spent 16 years, because that's the beginning of the 14th century. He played a major role also in the political events of his time. And like all these things, these people had a political axe to grind. There was Newton, who hated Descartes. Descartes, who questioned his religious upbringing, sort of. And a lot of these people, Kant was having a reaction to, Leibniz was having a reaction to Newtonian thoughts. The Newtonian revolution created, all these things are not just simple, they don't just simply stand on the shelf of philosophers, that they all have bustles and hustle and bustles. And of course, the Rome at the time was a bit like the sort of the White House. It sort of all power appeared to emanate from it, but no, not really. It's sort of a very, there's a whole lot of pageant and a whole lot of confusion in it. And it's very interesting to say, read that mathematics was not seen as, it was seen as a sort of almost magical art form that really intelligent people played, and there was this sort of myth of intelligent people that they could be put to battle. It's a very interesting time. Okay, so this is, I think, reminds me of reading The Quantum of Astrology, which I might get around to reading. Giles of Rome was an extremely prolific author and left a very large corpus of writings encompassing commentaries on Aristotle, theological treatises, questions and sermons. Now, so Aristotle was the main thing, and he makes a comment on it because Aristotle really causes great things. And it's the things that we dismiss in Aristotle were the most devastating. I think he said, there are 5,000 stars, and each star represents an angel. Therefore, people were just blowing their head. They're saying, each star represents an angel. There's only 5,000 angels, and if there's 5,000 angels, and there's, three ranks and three choirs in every rank, that means, etc., etc. They're just going in. It's sort of like a crazy world they're going into. So the problem with Aristotle wasn't the problem that we would find with Aristotle. It was completely circular, gibbledygook, not as we understand science, is not as we understand it. It was declarative and nominative science, not inductive science. Induction hadn't come across. So a lot of the modern ideas behind science hadn't emerged yet. In the last couple of decades, a research group originally led by Francesco del Punta, Scuola Normale Superiore Pisa, Italy, died in 2013, has been devoting a lot of his energy to the project of publishing the Opera Omnia and deepening our knowledge of his thought. So Pisa. So that's what the University of Pisa is doing. So you think it must be up in that part, but very, very interesting. So there is a person in that area. So I wonder if they've got a religious background. So he's just died almost yesterday, as far as this one's called. Although the group has produced extremely significant results, an assessment of Giles' work is still in progress. For this reason, the present entry only aims at providing insights into its ongoing process of research and will focus on the recent studies of Giles. So there you go. We're 2014. He's been dead for a good old 700 years. And we're only going, hang on, these people really, he's a really central figure. And he is a central figure in Newton. Because if you just throw away and say, oh my God, these school books are complete rubbish. Because if you read the original Latin of Newton, he is referring back to his environment. He is a bit of a genius of sorts, but he refers to his environment. His laws, he says, I already know him. They're obvious and self-evident. He says mass. I can sort of tell you, it's a sort of like mass has got to do with if something is very dense and has got a large volume, it's got a large mass. He could grab it this way. He tried to talk about mass, and he said, throw back to this person, Giles of Rome, if you look at it. And if you really don't care, you are just really not interested in reading Newton all that much, you just want to just go with the flow, just repeat slavishly what every school book has said, which is going off, oh, but you don't ever go into it. So I can imagine people now saying, some people stopping and asking about it. I certainly am. Going to section one, it's only just recently, just then, that I actually re-looked at the sort of convoluted symbol they have for the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. And what it is, it's pretty amazing. It's an S, an E, and a P formed into someone hunched over and thinking. It's rather a good idea. Okay, the life. Now, our good old Giles was born in Rome, most probably in the 5th decade of the 13th century. That's, perhaps you would go that from lifespans. Giles was the first outstanding theologian of the relatively recently founded Order of Augustan Hermits. Okay, so St. Augustine of Hippo, he's a great he's a Augustan mint. Monk, a hermit. Now, what's more fascinating is Aquinas, how the Augustine monks, Dominicans, and all that fit together. Must admit, I don't know too much about it. Nothing more is known about his origin. The statement that belonged to the famous Roman The statement that he belonged to the famous Roman family, the Colonna, seems to go back to Jordan of Saxony's Liber Vera Fratrum in the second half of the 14th century. But it is completely missing from contemporary 13th century sources. So we really know nothing about him. He's just appeared. He's an author. He didn't write anything on the back flaps. And someone's just said that he's from a famous Roman family. And it is interesting that these famous Roman families would be go back centuries more. At the beginning, he must have followed the courses either of secular master or theologian belonging to a different order, as the Augustan friars did not have a regent master at the time. So Augustine's a pretty new collab of the book. It's like a new university. It doesn't have a full set of faculties there. He probably was the pupil of Aquinas in the years 1269 to 1272. He commented on the sentences at the beginning of the 2070s. It's in the following years he most probably wrote also a large number of commentaries on Aristotle. He had to put a little bit of a comment on this by saying he commented on this, so therefore it must be around that particular time. It's a bit like if you watch Love Actually, and Hugh Grant, I think, says something about the Twin Towers, something like that, and plane going down. So you know that it has to be post-2001, but not too far post-2001. Or for instance, probably another thing I can think of is watching an airport movie, I think Airport 75 or something down like that. There's someone who puts a bomb on a Boeing plane and a hole's blown into it, and someone puts his face through it and says, "Boeing engineering, good old American engineering, these planes will never fall down." Well, you go, oh, that's an interesting aspect. Just reading about it, you can actually, if you're a scholar, you can actually put things in context. Now, you can put a few questions as to why these people think these various things. St. Thomas Aquinas and the Augustine. So he was an Augustan person, and which is sort of like your academic, and I'm just really trying to put in my head what the Jesuits were like. The Jesuits were much later, but how they have taken on the mantle as the intellectual aspects of the church. I think at this stage Scholasticism is doing all very well, and you've got to remember that Scholasticism is coming head to head with the Aristotelian Greek world, which the Christians had eliminated, but were coming back as various forms. In the year 2077, marked a turning point in his career. Okay, so he's just a person writing commentaries, but 2077, we know he's there, so we can sort of get his age, roughly. So he must have been at least probably 20, so that's reasonable. Giles was involved in the condemnation of a heterodox Aristotelianism issued by Parisian bishop Etienne Tempier, although the process against him must be distinguished from the famous decree of the 7th of March 2077, as Robert Wheelock has shown. So what's heterodox? So there's heresy. Heterodox means that you've got these orthodoxies, the Christian orthodoxies, the Aristotelian orthodoxies sat side by side. They didn't come across, but occasionally there'd be overlap, and then the overlap would lead to disaster. So, and then it would be coming in. They wouldn't burn everyone. They'd have to say, "Well, look, you've made a mistake here." No, you know, having the fires burning out, and you know that you're going to be burnt or hung or tortured. What's my mistake? I realised I didn't really understand what I was saying. That heterodoxy was different from heresy. Heresy, you're deliberately going out and changing. Heterodox is sort of a heresy, a in-house heresy, I would expect. Okay, but the heterodox means obviously a lot of these things are moot points. However, made politically bigger than they should be. And it's interesting how it goes. Listen to this. After 2077, Giles must have abandoned Paris, but his presence is attested in Italy not earlier than 1281. So there's a 4-year gap where we don't know. Before leaving Paris, he completed the Régime Principum, which is dedicated to the young Philip, the future Philip the Fair. Ooh, how does this all go? So he's writing heaps of things, commentary, you know, standard commentaries. He gets something and he's kicked out of Paris. It becomes a hotbed because it's not quite correct. Who is Philip the Fair? I really wish I knew. Now, between 1281 and 84, Giles played an important role in the government of his order. So he went back and the orders. Can you imagine? Now these things are starting off. It's sort of like the modern corporations. It's sort of like Coke or Apple. I have to say it's that. Taking part in various chapters held in Italy. At the provisional chapter at Tuscania, nowadays Liazzo, Italy, and in 1825 he acted as vicar of the prior general of his order, Clement of Osimo. So this is real middle age, hit your head incense type of time. This is real full on. This is the middle age. You've had William the Conqueror, the Normans, the Vikings going around the place. This happened a few hundred years earlier, but it's pretty amazing. So he's sort of one taking position of something in Paris has sent him into the admin arm of this newly emerging order. In 1285, Giles' doctrine was in the game. After recounting only part of what had been previously condemned in 1277. So Giles has written something which has got thing. He was allowed to teach again. Oh, okay. Okay, so this is the entire thing. He would have. He didn't have a heresy. He had something which was a bit weird. By 1287, he is referred to as a master of theology. His university quadlipta goes back to this period. For the academic year 1285-86 to 92-93. Okay. This success enhances Giles of Rome's authority even more in his order. His general chapter of Florence decreed that Giles' works, even future ones, should be considered as the official doctrine of the order, to be defended by all Augustine bachelors and masters. In 1292, the chapter general of Rome is elected prior general of this order. So, what happens is, this is sort of like scholasticism gone mad in terms of you can actually confer on an author who's dead, we've sized them up. Now you can confer on an author who's alive, and people should defend it. Now, the idea of defending points of view and muscling around is central to the Augustan way of thinking. And I've only really understood this from reading Augustan history. So what he would do is have meetings, and he'd have people around it who would defend a view, and the muscle men would defend a view, and if they won the argument, people just wouldn't have their heads. You know, the average person would not know to think for themselves, and if you had the town meeting and it was decided that this was it. People couldn't think outside the square, and so this is why you have orders of people going around thinking something. It's you build up. It's like a football team. A theological footy match. It's pretty amazing to actually try and understand. I haven't explained it very well, but I sort of got a very idea. It's sort of like people backing ideology and a football code. It's not that much different. And so if you get deemed by the club as an official club coach, you get in and you set the strategy and you bear it for your side. So you've got to understand that these orders, besides attracting people, being very attractive, being involved in wealth, it's pretty much like, why are the football clubs so wealthy? It's sort of a bit of scratch your head. Why they do nothing. They just walk around, turn up on a bus, kick a football. But they are very wealthy and important. So I think that's an important way to think of these things at this time. 1292, at the General Chapter of Rome, he was elected prior general of his order. So whatever does that mean? But it's interesting that the order has an election process. What is that going on? Is that mad as he can? Benedict Dante's election to the papal see marked a further radical change in his career. So he's a Boniface the VIII, appointed him Archbishop of Bourges. So it's like winning influences, like this mad medieval board game, and where people, you know, die. I can imagine sex happening everywhere. Yeah, it'll be really interesting in years to come if people can infer by some sort of AI this sex that was happening. As a matter of fact, Giles was very often absent from his see, that is, Bourges, spending extended periods of time at the papal curia. So the Pope gave it to him. So it's like a lord system. Now, what's really interesting is that the religious thing was, it's pretty much like the merchant. It's sort of an alternative to the merchant class. You can become famous and rich from nowhere. You just have to be smart. Whereas if you're a noble, your mum and dad had to marry your way in. In his De Renunciante, he defended the legitimacy of Celestine's abdication. What the heck? You think this is mad, you go back to 8th century or 9th century popes. And consequently of Boniface's election. So this is why Boniface would want me in. It's to do various things like Bacon, Francis Bacon. These philosophers were guns for hire, whereas the guns for hire thing got out of control with Seneca of Rome. When the contrast between Boniface the VIII and Philip the IV reached the most critical point, he continued to side staunchly with the Pope. So is that Philip the Fair? An important sermon defending the papal position has been discovered by Consetia Luna, and Giles d'Esclelia Postae undoubtedly ranks among the sources of the Unum Sanctum. Whatever does that mean? So who is Consetia Luna? But she's obviously interested in what's going on. I think it may have passed. It may be in the past. You can let bygones be bygones. But the Pope was having a fight with Philip. And it's really interesting, the Frankish kings and the power plays that goes on with them. Charles the Prestige decreased after Boniface's death, and even more with the rise of Clement V to the papal throne. Before being elected Pope, Bertrand de Got, as Bishop of Bordeaux, had serious conflicts with Giles. Oh, God, this is just insane. This unfavourable change, however, did not prevent Giles from playing a significant role in the debates of his time. Oh, God, how you shut him out. Around 1305-6, he took part in a commission which examined and condemned the Eucharistic doctrine of John of Paris. This might be the fact one. His Eucharistic doctrine, a former adversary of Giles during the conflict between Philip the Fair and Boniface. It's Philip the Fair. Who is Philip the Fair? In discussions concerning the Templars, so the Knights of Templars, yet another order of people electing themselves. I think they set up a state in Poland. Knights of Templars. They were sort of like a business knight, religious, a feudal spin-off that we have not even featured in midday. I think that they are truly the wandering knights of Monty Python and stuff like that. And where the Templar order goes and, what is it? I think the Knights of Templar wound up being mercenaries and wound up in Malta or some bizarre, their history is sort of, they've vanished. But of course they were the ones that fought the Mongols coming in, I think. Okay. So, in discussions concerning the Temple, which eventually led to the suppression of the order, Giles sided with Philip the Fair. What? So this is, he was against the Philip affair, but now he got Templars. Oh, suppression of the Templars, because they were deemed to attacking the Templars for devoting a whole and devoting a whole tract of Contra Exemptos to the thesis that their exemption from episcopal jurisdiction was the cause of their abuses. That is, that they set themselves up as a separate sort of warrior, knight warrior state. They set themselves up as a sort of like a militant religion. It's sort of similar to far-right people wrapping themselves in the flag and using all the symbols that society is normally using. It's essential. The Knights of Templar are an amazing thing to look at. So these are your old Knights. I think they've got a big cross. They were just out of control. They just, you know, crusade after crusade. They just mucked around the Middle Ages. I think these people really felt they were in the Middle Ages. I myself, looking into it, I'm saying there has to be drugs. How could anyone? There must be malnutrition or food poisoning or something going on with these people. It was a stark, raving mad place where these people are in. Okay. During the Council of Vienne, Gilles was asked to draw a list of errors extracted from the works of Peter John Olvey. Three of them were officially condemned by the council. Oh, yuck. This is just... look, there's all these people who you think are great people, but when you read about them, they're all busy in their age condemning people to death. Personal learned ignorance person from that area. Oh, I'm just trying to think. The name escapes from him, but he wrote about, profoundly wrote about justice, natural justice, and that you can be ruled only if you acquiesce to being ruled. People can represent you, acquiesce. It was Ricky. The name is just escapes me, but he was into hanging people. This person here, Bacon, got people killed. Everyone got killed. It's sort of like the most deadly world to be in. It's like thinking, it's like being special counsel under Bush or something like that. Or what's it, Trump? Relying on manuscript evidence and other sources, Giorgio Pliny, 2005, could identify which kind of theological and philosophical works Giles read, studied, and copied for himself during his long intellectual career. See, that's interesting. Now, it's sort of like this story has been told in two ways. One, the stories have been gone, and now the story is of him, but also featuring these academics who are trying to unpin it. And they're doing it in a very methodical scientific method. I like it. Pliny distinguishes three main periods. Pliny. The first one, before 277. Quite unsurprisingly, he reads Aquinas, not only the commentary on the sentences of the Dominican master, but his latest works. Yeah. So Aquinas is a Dominican, and they're Augustines. Aristotle, e.g., in these years, Giles owns an annotates copy of Nicomachean Ethics. What the heck is that? What does that mean? Avicentia and Averroes. So what is Nicomachean Ethics? He's also very well acquainted with the works of P.S. Dennis and Areopagite. In the second period, this is before where he's that's 1277 to 85, so he's gone along and he's got on the wrong side in Paris and has been kicked out. And then forced to leave the academic milieu, Gilles widens his interests. So that's interesting, things go against him. So that was the period he was forced to go. So he's now kicked out of studies. He studies many works of Anselm's, most theologians of his time were very selective in their knowledge of this author, and makes acquaintance with the works of Augustine, such as Confession and Soliloquia, which are quite unusual readings for academic theologians. So he was Augustine, but the theologians themselves didn't read Augustine, because Augustine's actually a bit of a rich, saucy, Mills and Boone, sort of very It's just something like reading him. It's pretty amazing. But it's interesting that at that time, the actual Augustans didn't read Augustus. There you go. Confessions. I think he's confession saying, I've found chastity very hard. Thank you very much. Grant me the will to have chastity, but not just quite yet, is his famous quote, Augustine quote. And this is true even today. Like people read selective philosophy, they don't go into it deep. But then if we get people who read selectively of people who read selective philosophy, and eventually you get people who know nothing. In this period, from his return to Parisian, from his return to the Parisian faculty of theology, to his death, Charles studies almost. Entirely the available works by Augustine, and acquires also rare treatises by Porcus. That is interesting. This is because he's another philosopher back then, a Roman philosopher. Gallus' increasing attention to Augustine is mirrored by his mature works and will influence those theological orientation of his own order in the following decade. So it's really interesting that these people were just like someone who really backed the old Anzac Code and stuff like that. It's just, when I think of it, like we're at this point in time in that we're trying to do too many things, that is, keep, I suppose, the returned soldiers faithful to what the brand is, but also reposition it such that it can move forward. Now, if you just move forward without forgetting the brand, you'll just fall about the place. So I sort of understand where he's coming from. Now we're just going to do a quick thing. Now you've got to also remember here that what's confusing here is that there's so many different strands. There's the modern philosophers looking into it, doing forensics of it. There's himself. There's people at the time, contemporaries, and he's going back to different layers further back. So this is a real tour de force of philosophical orientation. So part two, logic and rhetoric. So logic is thinking for yourself, rhetoric is getting closer. Rhetoric, I must admit, is the type of stuff I hear people who don't really think logically, they tend to use rhetoric to explain. So rhetoric and logic are slightly different things. Rhetoric, we would, I suppose, associate today with folk logic, that is, logic which is not really sound, but let's see what they have to say. After René Antoine Gauthier identified as Master Guillaume Arnauld, the real author of Lectura Superior Logium Veritum, attributed to Giles of Rome. Whoa! Okay, so Guillaume Arnauld is the real author. What? Interest in logical works focuses mainly on his commentaries on Sophistici Elenchi and Posterior Analytics. Uh-huh. So this is interesting. So basically, so that would be interesting, because if you can whittle down what people say, there's less contradictions, I would say. In his treatment of the Phallica Figura Dictonis, Giles provides to be brilliant and original representative of modistic logic, whose basis his solutions mainly on semantics of intentions. Wow. Adesso Condri, 92, infuriates Gill's commentary on Posterior Analytics as an example of his theory of truth, which brings the completion of Aquinas' shift from Augustine's influence to the Aristotelian approach. So let's rework that. Brings the completion of Aquinas' shift from Augustine's influence to the Aristotelian approach. So Aquinas is moving from the Augustine's really whack. You have to go, is a really is a very rich and flowering whack. Aristotle is also equally insane. But there is this shift in the Middle Ages, and it's happening here. Britannia, Bert Agner, 2002-2004, investigated the structure of this commentary, while Longwade, 2002, and Cobrini, 2002, drew scholars' attentions to Giles' epistemology. Giles of Rome also authored the most important commentary on the rhetoric of the Latin medieval tradition, which earned him the horrific title of the expositor of this book, and influenced all Latin medieval commentaries. Honorific. So, you've got to really understand, it's like reading, if you read the original Latin, it's like reading, it's like a bad teenager's work, I must admit. Constillo Marmo guides, studies Joel's approaches to the different translations to which he had access, and showed he had developed Aquinas's theory of passions in commenting on relevant portions of Aristotle's text. Trying to solve the same problems left open by Aquinas. My problem is that you really have to go, Aquinas was how many angels can sit on the head of a pin. Well, that's a stupid question, he said. Or he had some sort of I wish I could remember the names of these logical phenomena, these people, essentially they had sort of bypassed some of the fundamental questions which were addressed by the ancient Greeks. The ancient Greeks were really actually interested in, was there a concept, is there something conceptual, like a triangle, which exists before and after the universe, because the triangle's a concept. And here, these people are got the full-on mysticism happening in the middle of their logical thought. They're completely mad reading about. It has been suggested that Giles considers the rhetoric to be a sort of logic or ethics and politics. This brilliant interpretation still awaits, however, full development and articulation. Janet Coleman, 2000, also maintains that Aristotle's rhetorical method determines the substances of Giles' De Regimen Principum, but one should also take into account also Lydia Lowndes' 2001 remarks. So it's really in the flow of things. And it's sort of my overall view is that modern science has put a lot of this to and fro into death. And so the main question is, how is this sort of slightly tropo thinking still alive and kicking in modern day thinking, and how do you talk about it? Well, that's all for the moment. I'll get on to the next one pretty soon. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.